When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Welcome to our podcast,
Life After the Letters. I'm Amelie.
And I'm Suba.
We're friends that met whilst working our first shifts as junior doctors.
And we're here to talk about the stories and challenges that we face every day.
Our first and formidable guest is the wonderful and very humble Hazel Wallace. She's a woman that wears many hats and she wears them all very well. She's a junior doctor, she's a blogger, a best-selling author, and most recently, a fellow podcaster. You may know her better as the food medic. During her second degree at university, she began sharing nutritional advice, exercise routines, and the meals that she ate. She gained her second degree and a few hundred thousand followers along the way. Hello, Hazel.
Hi, thank you for the intro.
Was that cringe?
It's so weird listening to you explaining what I do. I'm just like, just sit quietly.
It's funny because I listen to Hazel's podcast, also called The Food Medic, and it's absolutely brilliant. And whenever she introduces her guests, it's like a really good introduction. And they're always like,
I really give their full bio. And it's a little bit long because they're usually very experienced. So I'll have like all of their degrees to listen. Sometimes it's a little bit long-winded, but I feel I owe it to them to share how qualified they are.
Yeah, because it's important. And yeah. I think sometimes as women especially, it feels a little bit difficult to go out and say everything that you do because it feels like we're boasting.
Yeah, so it's nice when someone does it for you.
Yeah, and you've done a lot, so it's amazing.
Thank you.
But this is funny because this is the first time we're meeting for like a couple of years now.
I know. How many years now? Four? No.
I think it's more than that, you know. I think we're getting old.
I was in my fourth year of medical school.
So was I. But I think I did another degree. Did you do another degree in med school?
Before med school.
So actually, no, because we would have started F1 at the same time. So maybe it is 4 years ago.
Oh my God, that's crazy.
Yeah. So what's funny is that we went to Stockholm as part of a trip with Nike. I have no idea why I was invited, to be honest, at that time. And it was like the best trip I've ever been on. But I think Hazel's been on several since then.
It's still like the best trip. Whenever anyone ever says, what was the best trip you're on? Like press trip. I'm like, that Nike event, because I was so grateful to be there, and it was such a good group of girls, and we had a really good time. So I loved
it. It was so good. Yeah. So back to this, and back to 2018.
I know.
So essentially, we've got loads that we can talk about, and I don't even really know where to start.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, let's go chronological here.
Okay.
So Hazel, did you know that you wanted to do medicine in the first place? And where did that thinking start to come in?
I decided I wanted to be a doctor after I lost my dad and I was 14 when he had a stroke. And it was around that time I got interested in healthcare. So I was originally planning on doing business or accountancy. Okay. So I changed all my subjects to all the sciences and studied for them. But I grieved pretty hard after I lost my dad, and not until I was about 16 it really hit me. And I didn't do as well in my exams, like my finals. So I grew up in Ireland and I did the equivalent of the A-levels. And so anyway, long story short, I didn't get all the grades I needed, but I got enough to do medical sciences or biomedical sciences in Dublin. But I was also offered a similar degree in Wales. And something inside of me said, go for Wales. So at the age of 18, packed my bags, moved to the valleys. Like it was literally in the middle of nowhere with sheep everywhere. And I did my medical sciences undergraduate. And that degree was, it was a really small group of us, 22, I think. But it was shaped for people who wanted to do medicine or something similar. So I went there and I was very, very determined to get into medicine from there. And at the end of that degree, applied for graduate entry medicine, and I started a 4-year graduate entry level at Cardiff then, and qualified then in 2016.
Crazy. And looking back at those people, the 22 of you guys, is everyone a doctor now, or did people take different paths?
No, I'd say about 6 of us are. Some people didn't get into medicine. Some people decided they didn't want to be a doctor at the end. Like one of my friends is a speech and language therapist. The other one's doing a PhD in Australia. We're all doing really different things. So yeah, it's interesting. But I think it really does teach you what it is like to be a doctor. And I think when people start the degree, they're like, whoa, actually, this isn't for me. And I'm sure you found the same. Even some of my F1 peers found that when they started working the job. It's very different doing it in medical school and then actually doing the job.
No, it's funny you should say that. Me and Suba talk about this all the time, because you make this decision when you're 16, 17 to choose the subjects you need to do. And by the time you get through medical school, you're kind of just on a fast track to being a doctor.
Yeah.
And I suppose the good thing about graduate medics is we always used to find the people who used to join us as graduate entry medics. They would just have a completely different mindset, because they were here because they know they want to do the job and they had the right expectations for the job.
Yeah, absolutely. I think also doing a degree before medicine almost got like that uni bug out of me. Like I lived my uni years and then I was ready to knuckle down and study.
Yeah, that was me from like fourth year. That's funny. And obviously we can't talk about your second degree at university without talking about where the food medic started and how that was born. Can you give us a good idea?
So the food medic was born actually at the very end of my first degree when I was studying for my finals. And I had quite a long lead up to my exams, like an 8-week window, where we didn't have many lectures and we had time to revise. And I used that time to join a gym and also start eating well, because I had gotten to the point where my own health was compromised, I guess. I'd really severe asthma, like terrible acne, and also I'd put on quite a bit of weight since I started uni. And I thought, well, I don't want to be a doctor who can't run for a bus. So I was like, well, I'll sign up to the gym, I'll learn a little bit about food. And then I got hooked. I got really, really hooked. Because I felt like my performance when I was studying was improving with improving my nutrition. I felt more energetic. I was going to the gym before I started going to the library. And those library days were so intense. Like, you know, you'd stay there till midnight and you'd be sitting in the same spot. So like breaking it up with exercise really helped me to study. And having a, you know, an interest outside of medicine also helped me stay focused and enthusiastic. So I started an Instagram account, a personal one to help me stay motivated. And then as I started really delving deeper into the literature, I thought, you know what, I could extend this from just myself and from my own Instagram onto a blog and help more people and hopefully help my future patients. And so the food medic was born.
And so how long did that process go on for? So you started it during your final year.
Yeah.
And then when did the blog appear?
Then the blog appeared that summer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because I went home for the summer and I really threw myself into it, because I'm just like the type of person that needs to be busy. And I thought that was a really good time to start the blog. So I started it then and entered graduate entry medicine. And I didn't really know if I'd keep it up, because I knew it was going to be an intense degree. And I did. I kept it up in the background, and it really, really grew at medical school, even though I tried to kind of put a lid on it. I was like, you know, let me focus on my degree. And it was growing and people were really interested. And I loved it. So I kept going, and it was in my final year of medical school when I was offered my first book deal. And I said yes. And I wrote my book on my elective.
No way. Isn't that crazy? Where was your elective?
In Sydney.
Okay.
Yeah. I it was great because I was away from everyone. Mm-hmm. I'd go in, I'd do my A&E shift, and then I'd come home and I'd write my book and I'd practice in my kitchen there. And it was great and I loved it.
And what a gorgeous country to do it from.
It was.
And such a like health focused country as well.
Yeah, it was really, really good. But it was a hard time because it was around my medical finals and the book deal. And I also wanted to get my PT qualification before the book came out too, so people would be would know that I'm qualified to give that advice also, because as doctors, we don't really know much about exercise. We know it's good for you, but that's about it. So I did all of the above at the same time, much to the detriment of my mental health, but we got through it. And I'm really, really glad that I did that and I believed in myself.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a real testament in following your passions and also making sure that you are qualified to give advice on certain topics like exercise and nutrition. And yeah. I'm sure you see a lot of people in maybe the Instagram or blog space who aren't as qualified or might be misleading people with information.
Yeah, it's not regulated what you say online. So anyone's a doctor or like anyone's a nutritionist, PT, whatever. So for me, it was really important because I want to be safe. And like we'll probably talk about it, but I'm going back to uni now in Woo-hoo. September to do a master's in nutrition, which I'm like, oh my God, this is going to be my eighth year of university. But for me, again, it's important, not only for having that accreditation, but also because I'm super interested and I want to really immerse myself. And I'm such an academic at heart that I'm really excited to actually write a thesis and
this little geek over here.
I know. So yeah, that's what's happening. I think we should all be encouraged to do lifelong learning. You don't just stop. And as a medic, you're encouraged to always be doing something, but it's easy to kind of slip into that little sweet spot where you're not really doing very much.
Yeah. Because actually, funny you should say that, but actually getting the title as a doctor, it almost feels like you've achieved what you need to achieve, but that kind of can make your learning stagnant. Mm. So I think it is important to keep pursuing it. So let me ask you this. So it was towards the end of your first degree when you started the food medic. Mm. How did you gain knowledge on nutrition? Because frankly, we just don't learn it in med school.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I started reading blogs and I think blogging was a relatively new thing then.
Oh my gosh, so new.
Yeah. And a lot of it was American blogs, but I was kind of a little bit confused reading some of the stuff because it was kind of pseudoscience. And because I was learning all of the science then and there, I was thinking, that doesn't really make any sense. But I see where they're coming from. And it was really it was really appealing, like all of these like claims they were making. So I wanted to know if there's any research. So I was like using PubMed to like search articles on these things. Like, is the ketogenic really going to cure cancer? Like, seriously, I had no clue because we didn't really learn about it. I mean, in all fairness, in medical sciences, I did a module in nutrition as part of that, but it was really like the intricate anatomy and, you know, biochemistry. It wasn't
And what is happening at a cellular level.
Yeah, it wasn't the practicalities, like, you know, what's a complex carbohydrate in terms of a food.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's what we need to learn as doctors when it comes to,
which is actually quite simple information for them to give
it
us.
It really is. It's the most basic thing, because telling a patient to eat more complex carbohydrates just makes no sense. You know, like, we have to speak to them in terms of foods. But anyway, that's another thing. So I really did just start reading papers and then start writing research-based articles in the form of blog posts, which is very different for most scientific publications. And a lot of my peers and seniors weren't really keen on it. Now it's a different story. Now I get asked to kind of advise on how we translate science to the general public, because everyone reads blogs now, everyone uses social media, and people want bite-sized chunks of information, but we need to make sure that they're coming from the right people.
Totally. So just to go through that. Mm-hmm. We talked about you in your final, in your first degree. We've talked about your second degree, which was medicine. Going through medical school, also having quite a well-known blog at the time, how did you find that? Did you find that, how did you find that having a blog at medical school and all the other medical students knowing that you had it?
I never put pressure on myself to, you know, blog a certain amount of time per week, because I was so grateful, and also because I worked so hard to get into medicine, I was like, nothing is going to stand in the way of this. I'm going to become a doctor. So my work always came first and then blogging came second, but it was almost like my escape. I'd use the gym at the hospital, which was right beside the library as well. So I kind of built up this little routine, and I feel like it really helped me at medical school, because a lot of people would think the opposite, did it hinder your performance? And I definitely was advised to stop doing it because my lecturers thought it might hinder my performance, which it didn't. I ended up getting on the dean's list for my final, so I did work really, really hard. Yeah. I didn't realize that all my medical student peers knew that I was doing my blog.
That's hilarious, Hazel.
I know. I just didn't really realize. And then someone mentioned it, and I was like, oh, how do you know I do that? And they were like, well, everyone knows.
Everyone knows.
I realized everyone was talking about it. And I'd say 90% of people were supportive, but there was times where, especially amongst the boys, where they'd make fun of what I did. And I came across that on social media once, and I remember having a really hard time about it because they'd never say it to my face. And I definitely questioned whether I was doing the right thing or whether it was just silly and I was, you know, just another Instagrammer. But something inside me made me keep going. And now it's much more than just a little blog, but it wasn't always easy. It's interesting, though, because I feel like that there's been a shift in mindset from the medical community. And now there's a lot of doctors who use social media to complement their career, I think.
Yeah, totally. And I think even when we look at our careers, there's a lot more that you can do, and you can make it into a portfolio career where actually the things that you're interested in and the things that you're most passionate about, isn't it better for that information to come from you and in ways which are more accessible to the public?
Yeah.
So actually listening to your podcast, I've been listening to it over the past couple of weeks since it came out, and I found it really educational and very informative. And it's crazy to me to think that I've only just started picking up on certain ways of explaining to patients how to look after their nutrition or what type of exercises that they can do and what's actually important for them to use as their parameters for health. And it's something I just never learned at med school. And it's something I didn't pick up until I listened to your podcast. Isn't that wild?
It is wild. And I mean, although I've been blogging with the Food Medic for 6 years now, but doing this podcast, even my mind is blown, because I'm learning stuff all the time and I'm just like, oh, I wish every medical student knew this. Yeah. I think that will change, because patients are demanding that information. They're like, hey doc, what should I eat? Like, is this exercise safe? This morning I was working with a cancer charity, and we're working on developing infographics for patients, young patients with cancer, so between the age of 20 and 40, on nutrition documents and also exercise, because they're like, can I exercise with a PIC line? What can I eat? Will dairy make things worse? Like, they've got so many concerns, and rightly so, because they're going through a hard time. So I think, I can't remember where I'm going with this now.
I liked it and I followed it the whole way, so I'm with you on this one.
But what I was saying basically is, like, creating those infographics for patients is really important, and doctors don't know that advice, or they might, but they don't feel comfortable giving that advice because they haven't been taught it. And
where I also think you're going with that is the fact that you actually sit within a very niche space. You sit in a space where you have a lot of nutritional knowledge and exercise related knowledge and how that can affect people on an individual level. But also you've had the opportunity to be a doctor and see patients and know what their needs are. So actually a lot of people don't have those two those two specific but important things.
Yeah. And it's so interesting because it's two different worlds, like working within a London-based hospital, particularly at 3 a.m. in A&E, and then comparing that to the kind of cohort of people who'd follow me on Instagram. It's a very, very different kettle of fish. Like, what advice I'd give to a, you know, someone who's coming to my Instagram page, they're probably going to be well educated on nutrition anyway, and they're going to be asking me like really nuanced questions, like what should I be eating after I work out, is this enough protein, blah blah blah. But then my patients who are coming through the doors of A&E are probably, they might not even be meeting their five a day, they may not have access to a kitchen. It's very different. And one thing working within the NHS, it keeps your feet in the ground and kind of your focus on what's going to help the majority of people rather than, you know, what's going to be optimal health, or even better health for these people.
Yeah. So I think that brings us on to the different communities which you have access to. So we'll definitely speak about the lifestyle medic community, but let's talk about the differences between the blogger community and also the medic community. Is there one group that you feel that you're more closely aligned to?
It feels weird. I don't really feel like I belong to either. I kind of feel like I'm the little bit of the Venn diagram in a bit. So it's like medicine, the blogger community, because there's a lot of things that I don't feel I align with in both communities. Blogging's notoriously just, there's a lot of bad blogging out there. There's a lot of good bloggers out there also. And what I love about the whole blogging community is that people are very motivated. They're really creative.
Yeah.
And I'm a creative person. Being a doctor doesn't allow you to be creative. You stick to guidelines and you have, it's very like, you know, X, Y, and Z. Yeah. Whereas when I'm working in the capacity of a blogger, I have to be a photographer, I have to be a writer, I have to be an editor, a director, I do everything. And it's almost like a manager. And I love that because I love taking the science and then breaking it down into accessible ways. But then medicine is where all my real love lies. I mean, I'm obsessed with the human body and, you know, I will listen and watch anything to do with the human body all the time. So it's really important for me to keep my foot in medicine at the moment anyway. I don't know where the future holds. I don't know whether I'll go back to full-time training. But I think for me, I am unique in that I straddle both fields. And that's almost why I'm going back to do my master's, because I almost see it as my duty of care to be that person who straddles those fields and brings them together, because ultimately we would have a better healthcare system if we could get more, if we could bring in more nutrition education in there and lifestyle education. It's not about retraining all our doctors, it's about making that information accessible. And I think definitely if we could start teaching at medical school, we would have, like, I feel like the doctors would feel better equipped anyway. Yeah.
And I think they would also feel more excited, because actually when you look at nutrition and exercise, it's what affects people on an individual level. So you'd be able to apply that to your own individual life and see, okay, these are changes that I can make, and this is the information I can give to my patients as well. And that's what makes medicine great, being able to relate to your patients on an individual level and see how you can best help them. So I'm totally with you on this, and I'm really excited that you're even here today to come and talk about what you've been doing.
So let's
go on to your next plans.
Nutrition.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm going back to do an MSc in Clinical Nutrition and Public Health at UCL. So it's a year-long master's, and at the end of it, I'll be a nutritionist, which is...
collecting the degrees.
It's crazy. And it's, you know, it's important to have the title, but it's not just that reason that I'm doing it for that. But in addition to that, I will continue to locum and run the food medic. But thankfully, the food medic is growing. It's always grown really steadily, but I'm able to have people help me now. I've got no one working for me full time. I wish I did, but I have like some people who help me with the website and scheduling and things like that, and really great videographers that I work with. And I guess what I'm trying to do with the Food Medic is pull myself from it a little bit, so it's less of I and more of we. So mm-hmm. the Food Medic is becoming a bit of an organization, and even how I've changed my website around a little bit, I've got an educational hub and I've got a group of contributors. And I keep a section for my medical students. So medical students around the country, I went through a process where they all put in applications. Well, whoever wanted to write for the blog, put in applications, and I selected four, and they're regular contributors.
How often do they contribute?
They do one a month each. So it means that we've got like one from each of them every week.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I've got other contributors, but it means that I'm kind of cultivating a population of medical students who are talking about nutrition and lifestyle medicine, but every article they write needs to be evidence-based, mm-hmm. needs to be referenced, and I need to review everything. So we know that everything that goes up there is correct,
yeah.
which it's difficult, but it means that it's inspiring them, and they're starting up societies and their medical schools. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that it will be this group of medical schools yeah. and that generation of medical students who will change the way we deliver healthcare. Mm.
It almost seems like the Food Medic and the whole lifestyle medicine movement is kind of creating a shift,
yeah.
and not only in doctors, but also in the public and public health generally. So I think that's important.
Yeah, it is.
So we've clearly talked about different areas and the different things that you do. So let's start with the Food Medic, the books.
Yeah.
So you got your first book deal, or got offered your first book deal on your elective in medical school.
Mm.
Can you tell us how that's transformed over the years and the two books that you now have?
Yeah. I actually always wanted to write a book, so I kind of had a plan of what it would look like.
Just interrupt, a recipe book or
educational book?
Okay.
Because I felt like when I was at the beginning of my journey, there was no middle ground between scientific publications and magazines or online content. Mm. There was nothing in between. And I wanted to be that in between where I can just deliver the basics of nutrition. So the first book, which was The Food Medic, the first kind of half of the book is just nutrition, the basics. And then I cover nutrition and health and how food interacts with the different body systems. And then I do all my recipes and a short workout guide at the back. So it was kind of like a textbook. But because I always knew what I wanted to do, I had my proposal written, and then someone approached me and said, you should do a book. And I said,
no,
yeah, I was like, I think I'll wait until I'm a doctor. And they were like, love, this takes ages to do. So yeah. Let's just get started.
The process isn't quick.
Yeah. So I started writing it then, mm. and I was offered a couple of book deals, and I went with one, my publisher's Yellow Kite, because they seemed like they really understood me.
Mm-hmm.
And I started writing it, and that came out May of 2017. Yeah, so I was coming to the end of my F1 year.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a doctor by the time it came out. And then I had 11 months to write my next one. And that one came out April of 2018. Yeah. So, I mean, the second one was only going to be a recipe book, but I couldn't help myself. I had to. It ended up being 60,000 words because I just had to put in all the information. But that one is very much, the information's broken up and spread throughout the book. And I've done like the FAQs I get is red meat, bad for me, and give people the information. Mm-hmm. I also talk a bit like on sleep and mindfulness as well, which I didn't before. And yeah, so they're my two books. And I think I will definitely do more in the future. But at the moment, because it is so time consuming, it's like more than a dissertation, I will focus on my master's and think about it another time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it also takes time for these messages to really sink into people.
Yeah.
And it really does make sense when you go through these books. Looking at your first book, for example, did you get a lot of feedback from that? And what did that look like from your followers?
Yeah, everyone loved it. It was number one bestseller on the first day it came out, and it was crazy to see going to Amazon and see it sitting number one
ahead see of your like, face sitting
yeah,
there.
In all categories, like above yeah. some incredible books, mm. like to beat The Body Coach, and I'm good friends
That's
with
wild,
Joe,
isn't it?
Was crazy. I was just like, I'm just going to celebrate this. So that was amazing, and it was really, really well received. But I was so open to feedback, and there wasn't that much negative, if any negative, but there was definitely feedback. And I think going through medical school, you are conditioned to accept feedback mm-hmm. and learn from that. And I did. So mm-hmm. in my next book, I brought all of that forward, and good and bad feedback. So the things that people loved was quick and easy recipes that were cheap, because my first recipe book, you know, I had to write that in a student budget in a tiny student kitchen with, like, you know, five housemates and, you know, like, you had stacks of pans yeah. and everything was filthy. So,
and it's actually funny, because if you think about just even the space that you have in university, it's tiny ass cupboards, so you don't even have enough space for everything that you would have at home.
No, and I had like access to like a small supermarket. If one of my mates would drive to the big Tesco, I was lucky. So
those would be my favorite days.
I know. Like, who's driving to big Tesco? So I think people then really related to the recipes, because it's not like I was putting in weird and bizarre ingredients that you had to buy in any of the niche whole food stores. It was just good food, mm-hmm. simple food. And so I made sure that all my recipes moving forward were quick, easy, and still healthy. People love the nutrition as well, but again, nutrition moves on, like with any science. Mm-hmm. So it's expanding on that. I personally felt that exercises weren't best placed in a book, and I didn't get that feedback, but for me, I didn't. So I decided not to put exercises in the next book and just focus on food. And although physical activity will always be important to me, I think you have to not pick your battles, but pick and choose what you're best at and excel at that, because you can almost do too many things. Yeah. And I was like trying to cover everything, because I just want to give everyone the best advice as I can give.
I was going to ask you that actually, because the reason I knew you in the first place was because you were almost a health and fitness blogger, and more so I would say fitness at the time.
Yeah.
And a lot of the things I used to watch from you were your fitness exercises and your routines, and I still do, and I know that you have them every so often now, but it seems that we've just gone into food and lifestyle and mindfulness, as you were saying, a lot more.
Yeah.
How did that happen over the years?
I think because I realized that there was a bigger need for nutrition, and there was a lot of people putting out physical activity kind of content, exercises and stuff, and they were doing it well, and they don't need more people like doing that. I can give advice on why it's good for you, but I don't think that there's good information on nutrition out there, and I feel like that's where I come in. But I would love to, I will go back to exercise, but I think from working within the NHS, I'd love to create more of a program that's tailored for people who are totally inactive, but maybe do a tiered program, mm-hmm. and whether that's an app or working with the NHS, I don't know. But I feel like as a doctor, when I'm advising patients to get more active, I find it really hard to advise them on where to
go.
Because I don't want to say go to Kayla, download Kayla's app, because they'll be like, who the hell's Kayla?
And I'm BBG.
Yeah, like I'm not going to do like 50 burpees. Like I don't want to give them a heart attack. And then I can tell them to do couch to 5K, but not all of them want to run. So I would love to see an app. And this is something
I'm so excited for you, by the way.
I know. I would love to do an app where I can like do it for beginners, intermediate and advanced, and we can help them meet their physical activity guidelines. Because I did my TED talk on exercise, so that was different. And I'm so passionate about it because I feel like it's free medicine. It's just, for me, the need from people, they always want nutrition.
But I think it's really interesting, as part of your degree next year, you won't just be looking at nutrition, but you'll be looking at public health as well.
Yeah.
And public health is so important. I think in your TED talk, you mentioned about the amount of girls doing physical exercise at school and how the numbers were so low. And actually, if we could increase the physical activity that people do, that will just send them on a really great health trajectory. I can't speak either today.
I know. We're like, it's the heat. But I think we need to encourage you know, from a really young age, getting more active, it's just normalizing it again. And I speak at like a lot of GP conferences and to trainees and things like that. And I don't know if you're familiar with social prescribing. It's like an initiative where GPs can prescribe non-medical kind of community services. So there's a link worker. They work between the community and the GP practice. And it could be like Mr. Jones comes in and he's very depressed and he keeps coming back and back. And the GP can speak to the link worker to say, what could we assign him to do? And that could be like volunteering. It could be a dance class, could be a cookery class. But it's so effective.
That's amazing.
It's amazing. But one of the other things on the back of that is now GP practices are joining up with park runs. You know that park run?
Yeah, yeah.
So like GPs can prescribe their patients park runs. Really? Yeah. So you can prescribe your patient a park run.
Oh, that's so cute.
And you can go as well. So it's like practice park runs. I don't know if you want to go running with your patient. But I mean, it's like things like that, normalizing it and having it as a treatment option is pretty cool. And I think the number needed to treat is, oh, I'm going to get this wrong. I think it's one in 12 for physical activity, but if for smoking, it's one in 100. So for every 12 patients you tell to exercise, one of them will, but it's like one in 100 or one in 150 smokers will stop smoking. So we have a greater chance of getting patients to move than quit smoking. So just say it to everyone.
Come on, guys, park run.
Yeah.
No, that's interesting you should say that, actually, because even those 11 who might not continue doing that every single week or whatever the parameters are, you've now made a little shift in their mindset. Now, I was listening to your podcast. I'm talking about your podcast this entire time.
I know.
I think it was Dr. Zoe Williams who was talking about how she just has a bicycle helmet on her desk. Do you want to tell that story?
Yeah. Cool. So we were on a tube on the tube coming back from a conference or something or a meetup, and we were talking about ways to get patients active, and she was like, "Well, I mean, I just leave my helmet on my desk and I don't even cycle, but I feel like I'm being a good role model." So then when she was on my podcast, I was like, I told the story. But, you know, she was kind of like, is it bad that I did? I'm like, no, it's like anything to be a good role model. Like it's if you are if your patient comes into your office and you're eating McDonald's or, you know, you look absolutely exhausted and stressed out of your mind and you're not looking after yourself and you're not. They're not going to see that they're not going to value their health. And I think it's not all about, you know, keeping up appearances. But if you can say, you know, I'm doing this too, and I also find it quite difficult. I've got a busy job and I'm going to go home and cook dinner tonight. If I can do it, you can do it. And I think I also feel like the success of the Food Medic is largely due to the fact that I was a medical student. I am a doctor. And they're like, whoa, well, she didn't know what she was doing at one point, and she was also very busy and she could do it. And I think when you're relatable, and that's the beauty of blogging, because there's a face to it.
Totally. So I think that's really important to discuss the practical ways we can affect change for patients. But going back to public health, there have been like quite a few public health campaigns which have come under fire recently. I say recently, probably in like the past year or so. And I think there was one that you commented on in particular last year. I should have told you this before the interview. But it was the cancer one and the big
obesity one.
Yeah.
Yeah, so obesity, and that was the cancer research one. And I commented on it because, again,
first of all, do people always ask you to comment on these big public health campaigns?
Yeah, okay. So the media will, but also I'll get pressure from, not pressure, but like, I mean, my followers will be like, hey, what do you think of this? And I do feel like it's my duty to speak up as a doctor. It's very nerve-wracking because it's a cancer and obesity, for example, are so polarizing. I do think that when it comes to the language around obesity, we need to be a bit more mindful because we know that it's not just caused by one thing. And the way it's portrayed sometimes, it's almost, and what a lot of people have said to me is, it's a lifestyle choice. And I completely disagree. It's not a lifestyle choice. Yes, your lifestyle can influence your chances of becoming obese, but to put it down to that is just not true. So my bugbear with this was, it said what is the biggest cause of cancer, and it said obesity, and you fill in the gaps.
Mm-hmm.
Being really pedantic, it does not cause cancer. You know, there's a link between a higher mm-hmm. BMI and cancer. So that was my first bugbear, but also was the messaging around this
totally.
Because there's people leaving the hospital and seeing that, like, I work largely in breast cancer services, mm-hmm. and they put that element of blame on them because it's just not helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to raise awareness that having poor health lifestyle choices can increase your risk of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
But doing it in a way that is not helpful and that can be shameful,
mm-hmm.
I think is just not right. And if we shifted it and turned it on its head and showed people positive ways to reduce their risk, moving more, eating a healthier diet, not
because
smoking.
Actually just having that poster doesn't really change anything.
No.
All it does is kind of empower those who might use those messages in a negative way to people who already are dealing with body image issues.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there was a very split feelings on that. I think I didn't feel like a lot of doctors were against it. I felt like a lot of nutritionists and dietitians were, and I guess because they're
but
very...
But that's because doctors also don't really have that much knowledge about what's going on public health-wise
yeah.
or also in terms of nutrition.
I think so. And I did get one follower who was really upset about it and said that she felt like it was irresponsible for a doctor to say that it wasn't a helpful campaign. And, you know, I addressed her concerns, and my responses are always very unbiased and just very clear cut. Like I just state the facts. I didn't feel like it was irresponsible. I felt like it was actually more responsible to give people what the actual facts and actual risks are. And mentioning everything else, where most people were very much for it. And I think after speaking to a number of doctors, they were like, actually, in hindsight, could have been done better. I hope that cancer research take that away. I know that a campaign is a campaign, and it needs to be kind of attention grabbing, but it
has to be done sensitively as well.
It does.
And also in context of the society which you live in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, isn't
it? I know,
it
is. But it's difficult commenting on something like that. Again, when you have two different kind of cohorts of people, your Instagram followers who are very much not at risk of becoming obese and are probably the worried well, and then your population within the hospital who are, majority of them, I would say, are of a higher BMI and could do with some health education. But also, you have to meet them where they're at and just scaring them and telling them you're going to get cancer because you've got a high BMI. I don't feel like that's very empowering.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
And clearly you have a lot of messages that you do have to share on social media. And as you said, people do look to you to comment on certain things. Are you ever concerned that it's going to affect you professionally or at work, say?
No, I don't think so, because I wouldn't talk about anything which isn't aligned with the food medic or kind of my values as a doctor, because I also have to work within my scope of practice, which again, why I'm getting another qualification, because it's important, and stick to what the GMC would deem appropriate as well. And that comes down to social media. You have to be so careful about what you put online. Any doctor does, regardless of how many followers you have. So I think it only helps, like this, like I write articles for other websites, you know, whether it's Traveler's Diarrhea, how to do a breast check, a self breast examination, for example, and GP surgeries and online, you know, websites that are suited for patients and doctors alike, share them and ask me to write for them. So I think I'm bringing that in closer together as mm-hmm. I move along. But there was a point where my blogging and my medicine was very, very different, very mm-hmm. separate. And that was harder because I kind of felt I was afraid to tell people about my blog, even though I loved it, because mm-hmm. I thought it would be seen as, you know, a little bit out there for a medic mm-hmm. to be doing.
Yeah. And I think actually when you were saying that people are advising you not to go ahead with your blog, mm-hmm. it just shows you sometimes how far away the medical mindset is from what's going on in the real world.
Yeah.
Because actually, all of us look to social media, whether we realise it or not, for information and for messaging. So what better way of using that space as a way of educating people?
Yeah, so, I think so.
And just going on from... So obviously we have a lot of doctors who listen to our show, and we have a lot of nurses who listen yeah. to our show as well. A lot of people who just generally work in the NHS. Is there anything that you would want to explain to them, or how would you advise them how to share messages with their patients on improving nutrition, for example?
I would say meet them where they're at. Mm-hmm. Like I said before, you don't know whether, you know, are they well educated in nutrition? Are they looking for, like, you know, nitty gritty details? Do they have a relatively good diet, or are they at the opposite end of the spectrum and they're eating like a terrible diet? Because you have to meet them where they're at, and giving them really advanced nutrition advice might not be what they need. They might just need some ideas on how to get more fruits and vegetables into their diet.
Mm.
Don't feel like you need to give more advice than you feel you can or comfortable. Mm. That's appropriate. As dated as it is, I always signpost to NHS websites and the BDA websites, also my own website, although it's like a little plug. But I think there is good information online, encouraging them not to use social media in terms of influencers unless they are qualified for advice, because I've definitely come up against patients who have come
in. That's interesting.
Yeah, and have, you know, fallen for like juicing diets, mm-hmm. Especially patients who are going through cancer treatment, and they think that that will be helpful. Not saying that having fruits and vegetables mm-hmm, mm-hmm. in a juice isn't helpful, but only having that
instead of your meals
mm-hmm. yeah. And I was just speaking to an oncology registrar this morning. She said one of her patients read that she should fast before chemo and then ended up having a hypo before her chemo and mm. was very unwell. So it just goes to show that food can be a drug as well, mm-hmm. And to just be careful as well. But really basic advice is sometimes what people just need, mm-hmm. and it's like eating more fruits and vegetables, eating more fiber. We get hardly any fiber here in the UK. I think we get about 17 grams, we should get 30. Mm-hmm. And it's not to say start weighing out your fiber, but eat more whole grains, you know, like try to keep the skin on your vegetables and roast it that way, getting the brown versions of food. Like, it's really, really simple advice like that. Cooking from scratch where you can, cutting down on like sugary foods and high fat foods. And it's really, really basic advice like that. And then if you want to get like into more nitty gritty things, like also encouraging people to probably cut down on their meat consumption. We're consuming far too much. Mm-hmm. You don't have to go teetotal on your meat or vegan, but cut down, and definitely on processed meat consumption.
Mm-hmm.
Try to get one to two portions of oily fish a week. And that's really it. But if you focus on one step at a time, I always say, you know, like how about this week you focus on getting your 5 a day every day? How about next week you focus on maybe getting whole grains into your diet, and that will be your focus for the week. The week after, make it a packed lunch every week. And yeah, it's like little things like that, and then it suddenly starts falling into place.
Mm-hmm. And does it tend to be GPs that ask you these questions, or what other types of healthcare professionals come to you for advice?
GPs largely, because I think they see patients at the start of their journey when they've just been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes or blood pressure, high blood pressure. So they kind of want to know what advice they can give to help manage that. But then I also find a lot of doctors within the hospital setting approach me more so for themselves, shift workers, because they want to know, what can I eat?
I'm just like envisioning you going to work and people just being like, Hazel, Hazel, just a quick question.
It's funny. It's but I mean, to be honest, not all the doctors and nurses in the hospital know what I do. You know, like, I'm still a part of the furniture. Like, I just go in and
Hazel, like every doctor. It's going around. It's you going just don't know.
I just don't know. But I do get some people like ask me, and sometimes like they'll be having like a cake and they'll say, oh, you'll think this is really bad. I'm like, hey, I'm not here to judge. I eat cake too. But like, it's just, I think a lot of people want to know how they can get the best out of their bodies and themselves, yeah, out of their diet. So, and hospitals are notoriously crap environments for food.
Oh, it's awful.
Like, try to get a good meal on a night shift. Unless you, like, I mean, I work close to Tottenham Court Road, so you can go out.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, I think you're okay.
But if you're working in the middle of nowhere, it's like a vending machine diet. I know we don't have warm food at night. So no. I personally bring my own packed lunch. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the other doctors do a McDonald's run at 3 a.m. McDonald's or Domino's.
Like, it's not good, but sometimes that's the only food that's available, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, like, that's why I understand. I think once-off basis, absolutely, we still do Franco Mancas on a Friday. Mm-hmm. Like, that's fine. But if you're doing a lot of night shifts and you're eating that food a lot, it's not going to be doing a lot to your health, but also your performance as a doctor. And we have a duty of care to do well, and do the best for our patients. Mm-hmm. I think like 4 a.m. is the biggest dip when our patients go off, but we also kind of,
my consultant loves dropping that, by the way,
the 4 a.m. dip. Oh my god, yeah. He's like, just check all your vitals at 4 a.m.
He's like, I dare you to do some reading at 4 a.m. and I'm like, what? And he you know, when it just doesn't make sense sometimes.
Yeah.
No, that's funny. But actually, I really want to talk to you about the ways that you yourself have made changes in your life, because notoriously for doctors, it is difficult to get the food that you need to get and live a healthy lifestyle, particularly when you're doing like your shift patterns, whether that's in A&E or, to be honest, a lot of our surgical or medical jobs. So you talked about bringing your food into work. Is there any other ways that you would suggest people could improve their lifestyle?
Yeah, so I think it's easy for me now because I've been doing it a long time, but meal prepping your lunches and also your dinners, because I think, and sometimes shifts are so long in hospital, it means breakfast, lunch and dinner.
Yeah, I was just about to say that. Yeah,
but doing that on your days off and just prepping ahead, and it does take a little time, but it means that you always have food available. And
you also save so much time, don't you?
You save so much time because sometimes, you know yourself, you'll say, I'll get lunch at 1, but then 1 becomes 4, mm-hmm. and then you're not eating. And I've had plenty of lunches on the tube home at 7 p.m. and that's just the way the cookie crumbles. Yeah. But if you have it ready, it means you could probably nip into the staff room for 10 minutes and have a quick lunch. Mm. It's not ideal, but it means you're getting a bit of food. And for me personally, I feel like I'm better able to like think when my stomach isn't grumbling and I'm like hangry on a ward round. Yeah.
I also think it's important to take that time out, even if it means with your lunch, just to sit down 15 minutes, 30 minutes, just to have your break and get back to who you are before you go out there and work. Because you're working 12 hours. Yeah. What's 15 minutes going to...
Yeah, I know, absolutely. Make that time and just tell someone to cover you. Like, I think nurses are quite good. They like organize with themselves. Mm-hmm. Take your break now, take your lunch. Whereas doctors are like, like, you could just can't leave. You're scared to leave. So just,
it's so funny.
Yeah, it's hilarious. I think food's important as well. Try to exercise as much as you can. I'm like, on the days I'm doing an early shift, I will either exercise on my way home or I will get up and do a workout. I don't do it every shift, every kind of working day that I'm doing, but try to exercise at least like 3 to 4 days a week, even if it's 30 minutes, or walk part of your commute, do something. Try to sleep. I think we are terrible at sleeping. So try to get in good quality sleep. And it's not only just getting your like 7-8 hours, it's good quality. So like not watching Netflix till all hours or going on your phone, like creating an environment where you have really sound, peaceful sleep. That will not only improve your performance, but also your just your health overall. And read Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker.
Yeah, I'm like halfway through it.
Really? I keep dropping that book in every podcast.
I think it's
so
great.
It's just blown my mind.
Yeah.
And I feel like we all think that we're sleep experts now, but I mean, it's great. Yeah. So I think sleep's important. Having some form of stress management, because we are constantly in this state of stress, like this sympathetic stress state, because your phone and those notifications and even the your watch, your smartwatch, you're constantly being buzzed. And being a doctor or a nurse with pagers going off and like drips bleeping and everything, that amount of adrenaline surging through your body and cortisol isn't going to do you any good. But if you have mechanisms in place that help chill you out, like mine is 10 minutes of meditation, which I know isn't everyone's cup of tea. I've actually started prescribing, right, the Calm app to my patients. I say
it's a great app.
I just say try for 7 days. Yeah. If you think it's crap, then it's fine. It's not gonna do you any harm. And I just do that, and then next time I'm like, how are you getting on with a Calm app? I might never see them again, but I just hope that one of them will pick it up and it will be useful. But it could be yoga, it could be walking, it could be having a bath. I don't know, whatever floats
whatever
your boat, just do it.
Like
just do it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And how long do you think consistently you've been a bit more mindful or taking time out for yourself to meditate?
I would say only a year. Okay. I remember the first...
That's a long time, Hazel. That's
More...
I think that's a habit.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about if you've been able to do something consistently for even a couple of months, I think that's pretty good going.
Yeah, it was... I always thought meditation was not for me, tippy-dippy and whatever. And I did. I tried it once in a really nice place when I was in Ibiza last summer. And it really worked for me for the first time. And I was like, this isn't so bad. And I think because someone said to me, there's no right way of doing it, you don't have to empty your head, because I was like, that's not possible.
Impossible.
That is not possible. And now I use the Calm app, and I have used it for that whole year, and it's really, really helped me. But it does take time to build it into a habit. But before that, I was a mess. I was such a mess, because I was coming to the end of my F1 year. I just launched my first book. I had to write my second book. I got strep throat. And after my antibiotics, then I got gastroenteritis.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was like, oh, it was so bad. Yeah. And it was in the pits of like the hot summer. And I was doing a acute surgical kind of rotation. And I remember thinking...
So everything was kind of thrown your way at that time.
Yeah, I was just like, I need
something.
Something. Yeah. And then meditation came along, and I just grasped it. It wasn't the only thing that helped me get better. Definitely dialing back my work. I think something else that we should mention in terms of looking at our lifestyle is also social. Like, we forget about how important social connections are, but like being socially isolated, or even you can be surrounded by people but feel isolated. And I think a lot of doctors suffer from that, especially when you have to move to different hospitals all the time. You have to meet new people.
You might be away from your family. Look, your family are in Ireland.
Yeah.
It makes a massive change. Just being able to have people close by to you.
Yeah. And
who you connect with.
Absolutely. And not everyone likes their team, or, you know, so it's good to have that. And I think that's what I'm doing now. I'm like, I try to like keep in contact with my friends as much as I can. You know, next week I'm actually meeting up with the girls I started F1 with. And it's just nice to have that. I suppose you bond as F1s because you go through
a
crazy experience together. But yeah, I think it's really important when you are working at a really difficult job to have people around you, and any job.
Yeah. No, totally. So, yeah, I think we always talk about mindfulness, and we also talk about making sure that we do have these social connections around us, because I think sometimes as doctors, we're kind of tricked into the mindset that actually you can get everything you need at work and that you don't need to develop other things outside of work to feel fulfilled or to feel calm and all the things that we need in life. But I think quite clearly, just from the conversation we've had today, actually it is important to be looking at our sleep and how mindful we are, how much time we take out and what we're eating and just the things that kind of build up your everyday. So, yeah, I think that's a good consideration to make for all of us.
Yeah, they're basic human needs that we just neglect. Like most people would rather sideline their sleep for another episode of Netflix, and because it doesn't have like a stop, it just runs through.
Yeah, it's really hard. All you do is click skip intro.
I know, and I mean, I don't have a TV. And I was flying back from on a long haul flight recently, and I got hooked on the Peaky Blinders, and it's the worst for my productivity. This week I've been useless because I'm like, oh my god, I need to watch another episode. And everyone's like, what's wrong with you?
You know, when you're like, okay, look, it's 12:30, I can get another one in. Yeah. And you're like, oh no, it's 1:10 now. Might as well go up to 2:00. Just what kind of nonsense is that?
I know, it's madness. So I need to stop that.
I'm literally the worst for TV, so I can't even say anything. No, it's so funny. Look, we're coming up to an hour nearly.
I know, it doesn't feel like it.
No, it doesn't. So let's go on to what your plans are. We kind of talked about your plans for the future.
Yeah.
Clearly, you want to do a lot in terms of public health and working with different bodies and organisations into making nutrition and exercise a part of basically our national culture.
Yeah.
And you're going on to your nutrition course in September. Is there anything else that you're looking to do or anything you're hoping to dip your toe in?
The podcast is a big thing.
Yeah,
it's really...
I love the podcast, guys, if you can't tell already.
Yeah, I love it too. I really enjoy it. I just, like I said to you, I'm learning so much, and it's quite nice to interview people and be on the opposite end. Although I do like talking as much, so this has been really lovely.
She says that after an hour of talking.
Like I said at the start as well, I'm trying to create the Food Medic to become more of an organization, a foundation where we are almost a media group sharing evidence-based advice between nutrition and medicine. And on the back of that, I'm actually organizing my first conference.
Yay!
And it's going to be hosted by scientists for the non-scientists.
Amazing.
Yeah. So.
Oh, that's everything.
Yeah. So keep your eyes peeled.
Guys,
she's
smiling. But
it's going to be in November. I'm smiling because I'm like, what the hell am I doing? This is so stressful. But it will be a day-long event looking at food from sustainability to health, planetary health. Also some cool things going on like cookery demos. So it's not like your typical conference, more of a festival where I'll have different stages. And yeah, it's going to be start of November. I haven't announced it yet because we're just securing all the things. But that will be cool because it's not been done before.
No,
yeah,
not at all. What a great way of combining the two worlds again.
Yeah.
So we talked about how you have your 4 medical students who contribute to your blog, and also clearly you have great publishers and people that you work with. What does your general team that you work with on a weekly basis look like?
So I have my management team who don't just work with me, they work with lots of different talent. And I signed with them when I was in my final year of medical school.
So you've been with the same team?
Yeah.
Oh,
and I've never changed. We're kind of like family now. Yeah. So they're great. They work with the kind of are the middleman between book deals and jobs that I need to book. They do all the dirty work like contracts and stuff, which is really great because I'm useless at that and I don't like talking about money or, you know, work schedules and stuff. So they're really great. I work with them, but on an ad hoc basis. So they just kind of, we chat on and off all the time. I have a girl called Jemima who is kind of like we just promoted her to media manager. But she works with me on like, you know, like my little infographics for like social media, my swipe ups and stuff like that. Helps me write.
And they're so clean.
Yeah, they're so cool. I love it. And my newsletter and like uploading stuff on my website because when things go wrong, I'm like, I don't know what's happening.
Yeah.
And then I've got like my medical.
And these things take so much time.
They do. I've got contributors. I have like some core regular contributors and then people who come on an ad hoc basis. It might be someone who's written a PhD on something that's interesting. So recently someone wrote a PhD on weightlifting and stigma in women.
Ooh, interesting.
And I was like, that's interesting. Come write my website. So I get people like that and I kind of like source them out. I've recently taken on a PA, which sounds really weird, but she works, it's kind of like all online and it will only be like 6 hours a week and it will be little things like scheduling and stuff like that, which is really useful and I didn't realize I needed it. And other than that, that's it. I mean, like I'll work with some videographers if I need to and I create all the content myself. I do all of the writing under my name by myself, which takes up a lot of my time. And I work...
And you're editing everyone's articles as well, aren't you?
Editing, yeah. Mm. So it's kind of like being a teacher. But I work with other brands all the time as well. So that requires days out of my schedule. Like last Friday, I was working with Lloyd's Pharmacy on their type 2 diabetes campaign. So I went to Birmingham and I did, you know, screening. So we'd go through a questionnaire and I'd do finger prick tests for people. So I do like media work as a doctor as well. And I love that. That's cool because it's different. Yeah.
It's also necessary that someone does it. Yeah. And you're a good person to do it.
Yeah, yeah. No, but I didn't like it in the beginning. I was like, oh, I have to. I don't like my voice. I don't like seeing myself on TV. And now I love it because I'm very comfortable. Mm-hmm. And like you said, someone has to do it. So it's quite nice to be the one that does it.
And you clearly have to have built confidence to do a lot of the things you have done over the past couple of years. Did that come easily to you or is that something you've had to be working on as you go along?
No, I think at medical school, if you asked me to do a presentation, I would have been like, no, I just would stutter over myself. And I was you probably can't really hear my accent very well, but I used to be really, not ashamed, but I'd talk it down. I'd try to beat the Irish out of me. So I never liked speaking in public. And then with this job, I was almost forced into it. But now I really enjoy it. And I mean, we mentioned before, but I just did my TED talk and I was so nervous, like sweating, hyperventilating.
You did not look nervous at all?
I was so sweaty. And it was TEDx Youth, so they were young people. Yeah. It was 2,200 people in the audience. Mm. That was my largest audience, aged 12 to 26. And you go from behind the curtain and there's like 50 people on their computers doing this fancy stuff for like, and I'm like, they put this Britney mic on you and I give you a clicker and I'm just like, oh, no, is it too late to back out? I can't do this. So forcing myself into that, but then I come off stage and I'm like, let me do it again. Like that adrenaline. But you can teach yourself. Like no one is good at that the first time they do it. It's practice. It's like with anything in life.
But practically, how have you built and developed that ability to talk to big groups of people? Like, for example, your TED talk, how did you prepare for that?
I first heavily researched it and made sure I was really confident with what I was putting out there. And I rehearsed it to a T. Like, the night before, I had my mum on Skype and I was like, sit there, you're going to listen to this 10 times. And that's how I got confident with that. But most talks, it's really just being confident in yourself. Like, I do really, really different things. I was actually went back to Sweden this summer to the exact same park we were in.
No way.
But this time I was doing a cookery demo.
That's crazy.
That is crazy. And I was just like, I was here like 3 summers ago. And I did a cookery demo with all these global chefs. And that in itself is nerve-wracking, but you just have to step up, own it, be confident in what you're doing. Fake it till you make it. And
about faking it, because you've been called to come up there for a reason.
Yeah.
Not the next person, but you.
Yeah.
Because of the things that you've done.
Yeah.
So you're meant to be there.
Yeah.
No, it's dope.
Thank you.
It's really great and exciting to see young women, particularly doctors, for me in particular, just because I think going through medical school, it can be, you're kind of directed in one path to become a consultant after going through your registrar training. And there's not too much space for pursuing your passions, and you don't really see it in a lot of people. So to see people like you has been really exciting for me, and I'm sure I'm speaking on behalf of a lot of our listeners. And we're going into a world that's changing, and our world is becoming closer and smaller, and the knowledge that we have access to now is completely different. Yes, there are some bad pieces of knowledge out there and information, but a lot of it is good, and it's good to see people contributing to that positively.
Yeah.
So thank you, Hazel.
No worries. Thank you for having me. I mean, it's been great.
Oh. So, yeah, thank you for talking and coming on the show today. I hope you've enjoyed our cute little studio, Mare Street Market.
It's really cool here, I'm just saying. And also the food looks really great.
It's gorgeous. I think the food is by Gizzy Erskine.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's her.
She's so cool.
She's so cool and so cute with her hair.
I know. Yeah.
So let's grab something afterwards.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye, guys.
Today's episode was recorded at Mare Street Market.
Catch us over on www.afterthelettersmarket.com or /afterthelettersmarket on every social media network.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.